Hey, football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown in the game, but his teammate scores instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you a second chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. With BetMGM's second chance offer, you have a chance to keep the fun going after the first player crosses the goal line. Try a first TD score wager with confidence today. BetMGM, make it legendary. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This specific promotional offer is not available in Mississippi, Pennsylvania, Puerto Rico, or Ontario. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 for New York. 1-800-NEXT-STEP for Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 for Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-ALL for Iowa. 1-800-981-0023 for Puerto Rico. Existing customer offer. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards paid back and unrestricted withdrawable funds. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
To find out what's really going on behind the music, sometimes you have to dig deep. I'm Dr. Mike, and on the new season of Going There, we're doing just that.
Art or music can be your escape and your therapy.
Going There is the podcast at the crossroads of music and mental health, where we have raw, meaningful conversations with artists like Noah Kahan, Julian Baker, Jason Isbell, Youngblood, The Head and the Heart, and Bishop Briggs.
I recently heard someone describe grief as glitter, where you'll clean it up, and then you'll find little pieces.
By opening ourselves up to these real discussions about mental health, we can foster understanding and gain even greater appreciation for the music we all love.
For me, like, my favorite songs give me happy tears.
So join me and some of your favorite artists on the new season of Going There with Dr. Mike, brought to you by Sound Mind Live and the Consequence Podcast Network. Subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts.
So you want to be a rock and roll star? No? Well, how about a podcast star? Well, as it turns out, there's a new all-in-one platform just for you. It's called Anchor, and it's the easiest way to make a podcast. And check this out. It's free. There's creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. And then Anchor will distribute the podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify and Apple Podcast and, you know, everywhere else in podcast land. And what's even better, you can actually make money from your podcast. Go figure. No minimum listenership on that. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. So go ahead, download the free Anchor app right now or go to anchor.fm to get started. So what are you waiting for? Podcast stardom is within your reach.
The Opus, an exploration of legendary records and their ongoing legacy. Not just their history, but how this music continues to evolve. We're opening the vault on classic records upon re-release, delving into their inner workings and their lasting impact. Maybe you're a longtime fan and wants to go a little deeper. Maybe you're a first-time listener and you're curious to hear more. Either way, you're in the right place. Find us at Consequence of Sound or wherever you tune in to podcasts.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey, welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith With. It's an audio interview series presented by WFPK Independent Louisville at WFPK.org. Consequence of Sounds and the Consequence Podcast Network. Take a second before we get started to hit the subscribe button wherever you're listening from today. Whether that's on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, really wherever you're listening from right now, there is a subscribe button right in front of you. I put out interviews every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at Consequence of Sound and would love to keep you up to date. I'm Kyle Meredith. Today, my guest, I'm once again talking with Steve Hackett, formerly of Genesis. He has a brand new record out called At the Edge of Light. This follows up last year's success off of a live album, which we also got to talk about, and we'll learn how that live album fed into this new studio recording. It's an album that's also reflective of not only what's going on in America, all over the world, and specifically in the UK where he's based, dealing with Brexit over there. Themes of darkness and lights, but he also hits on American politics, specifically with a song called Underground Railroad. We'll learn about all of those songs and how they all filter into one track that wraps up the record, simply titled Peace. We also get some insight onto what he's doing on the upcoming tour. In fact, he's going to be doing Genesis Selling England by the Pound all the way through and putting a big spotlight on his own solo recording, Spectral Mornings, which turns 40 this year. It's always a pleasure and an honor to talk to him. It's Kyle Meredith with Steve Hackett.
How are you doing?
I'm great. It's great to talk to you again. Congratulations on the new record At the Edge of Lights.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. It's gone down really well so far. It reached a number six midweek national charts in the UK, so it's doing the best I've done for 37 years or so.
That's great. You know, this comes after quite a bit of buzz of last year's live album, too, which, you know, I got the honor to speak to you about as well. Did this new studio record, did the live album have any influence on it? Because it sort of feels like it might have.
I think so. I think most of the stuff was being centered on Wind and Wuthering at that time. But when I go out this year, I'm just about to embark on shows. I'll be doing the whole of Selling England by the Pound. So concentrating on another sort of era of Genesis. And I just did an orchestral tour with, you know, band and orchestra. So I think the album has a whole ton of, the current album has a ton of orchestra on it. I think it's the most integrated version of that. But it's also got the long song, so it's a kind of, it's got that journeying musical continuum feel to it.
And you're using, as you've been talking about in other interviews and press releases, a lot of folks from a lot of different cultures, once again, as your band. Yeah. And I was wondering, does that happen naturally for you, or do you actually specifically seek that out?
Well, the thing is, I've made friends with people all over the world, and I would never have believed it at one time that I would have somebody from Azerbaijan playing the tar and a lady playing the sitar, who is an incredible virtuoso called Shima Mukherjee. But it's wonderful to work with people all over, you know, from Iceland and from Hungary and the UK and the United States. So it's a bit like a kind of, I suppose, United Nations or a fellowship, perhaps. And it's lovely, you know, in these days when politicians are trying to sort of separate us all out, that music ignores borders and does, flies through walls and borders and bridges and all that kind of stuff. So it's part of the audio fight back as well, to say that you can do stuff that's accessible, that's got a nod to world music, but it's still a rock album and broadening rock's shoulders to some degree.
You get into those themes, of course, all throughout the record. I mean, I hear you talk about how, you know, furthering what you're saying there with multicultures, this album's based on a lot of darkness and light to reflect world happenings.
Well, I think so, yeah. I mean, you know, we're at a very dark time in Europe right now with the rise of the right and Brexit and all of that. And I'm supposed to be touring in Europe a month after Brexit is supposed to happen. Some of us are trying to frustrate that process so that we stay, you know, friends with all of our European allies, was the word at one time. I'm signed to a German record company. You know, we've buried the hatchet long ago, but it seems that politicians over here seem to be determined to bring about the economic collapse of the UK. And we're just trying to do what we can without blowing up the Houses of Parliament, you know. We don't really know what we can do other than doing an album like this, which shows that people can get on from everywhere. We should be celebrating the best in the world in every field, it seems to me, you know, that way round. Not being idealistic, but, you know, we're trying to get rid of diseases and economic hardship, famine and all that stuff. It isn't going to happen unless everyone puts their heads together. We've got all the technology so that people can do any kind of stuff at a remote distance. You can make films like this. You can write books like this. You can make albums like this. All you need is friends.
You know, it feels like what you're talking about, or maybe it's coincidence, that the song titles actually decrease to the word peace. Even the length of the titles, it seems to all filter down to the last song, which is peace.
The last song is peace. It's a ballad. It starts out that way, but it grows from that. And the things that precede it, there's two tracks. There's Descent and there's Conflict. They all run as three tracks. So you get a feeling of a build-up, almost like a kind of arming feeling. So you go through armament, the build-up of tensions, and then it's a sort of musical depiction of all-out war. And then you get, you know, this kind of resolving, peaceful thing that's got a spiritual aspect about it as well.
And America is represented here. I mean, you wrote about the Underground Railroad. What inspired you there?
Well, I was in Delaware, Wilmington, Delaware, and walking by the river and reading the story of Harriet Tubman and the Underground Railroad, which was a movement that helped slaves escape. And then I read a book two years later by Colson Whitehead, and it's an international bestseller, which was recommended by Barack Obama, and same title, Underground Railroad. And I thought, this has to make a song. So I've met the McBroom sisters, Lorelei and Durga, both of whom have incredible voices. And I said I wanted to do something that had a kind of gospel feel to it. But then they got a chance as soloists as well within it. So something that's, forgive me for being, a white European with this, but I wanted to do something that was pure Americana with harmonica and dobro and all of that stuff. So they give it a kind of vocal authenticity that I doubt I could bring to it solely on my own.
Yeah, I mean, that dobro and the harmonica itself really puts it into an era and a time.
Well, I think so. I mean, I grew up playing harmonica 10 years before guitar, so I was fully conversant with that. My dad was able to play a number of wind instruments and introduced me to my first chords on guitar, so I was very lucky to have that in-house. And, of course, then I discovered blues and fell in love with the sound of that. I spent a little bit of time hanging out with Larry Adler in England as well, a couple of evenings with him, and that was extraordinary because I'd listened to him when I was a child, listening to him do Rhapsody in Blue, one hand on the piano, one hand on the harmonica. Extraordinary to see that level of talent, and he was still doing it, way into his 80s.
You mentioned going on a tour and doing some of Selling England by the Pound. Did I read that you're also going to be kind of putting a spotlight on Spectral Mornings as well, since it's turning 40 this year?
That's right, yeah. I'm doing the whole of Selling England by the Pound, certainly most of Spectral Mornings, and introducing stuff from the new album. So I hope that we'll get a chance to do maybe half an hour's worth from the new album, and also with the Selling England stuff to use a song that was like a deleted scene, if you think of it as a film. There was something that Peter Gabriel and I wrote. So I'll be doing that live as well.
Now, when you do that, do you go note for note to recreate it, or are you letting these songs kind of transform and grow in any way?
Well, some things go into improvisations, like the end of Dancing with the Moonlit Night goes into a jam, basically, a very quiet jam. And then I Know What I Like is an excuse for a jam anyway. That's what it was born out of. So it's not note for note, but then the rest of it, I think, I try and keep it authentic. The keyboard solos remain the same, and I do the same solo from Firth of Fifth, for instance, because it's so much part of the song, there's no point going off on a bender there. I want to keep it all authentic.
Well, I'm excited to hear how it all sounds out there, and especially how you integrate At the Edge of Light in it. It's a really fantastic record. Congrats on the continued success, Steve, and it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Lovely, Carl. Thank you very much. Nice to talk to you, too.
And my thanks to Steve Hackett's. The new record is called At the Edge of Light. Now, since Steve and I were also talking about the live album he did just last year, I want to include that interview as well for a little context. So here's a nice little bonus. It's part two of Kyle Meredith with Steve Hackett.
Hi, Kyle. How are you doing?
It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, nice to talk to you, too.
Yeah.
Nice to talk.
Hey, congratulations on this live record. It is a whole lot of fun to listen to.
Thank you. It's doing well over here. It's gone to number one in the Amazon chart in the UK, so I'm very happy with that. It's all downhill from here, of course, but there we go. Nice to get some good news.
All downhill from here, that's right. There's a concept behind this. Do you want to set up the concept before we get too far into it?
Oh, sure. Well, I was celebrating the 40th anniversary of Wind and Wuthering, which was released in 1977. So the 40th birthday was 2017. So off the Genesis set, we do quite a few numbers from that. I don't do the album in its entirety. I just do what I think is the strongest stuff from it, which means we do an 11th Earl of Mar, One for the Vine, Blood on the Rooftop, In That Quiet Earth, and the other one, Afterglow, plus another tune that was recorded at the same time in the same bunch of sessions that a number of us think should have been on the album. I know Tony Banks, and I think it should have been on the album, and that's a track called Inside and Out. So we do that as well. It was only issued on an EP, but it was Phil Collins' first complete lyric for the band back in the day, and it should have been on there.
Righting the wrong, that's what you've done.
Well, that's what I do, yeah. You know, it's the nearest thing to a director's cut and a kind of act of restitution and restoration and all of that. Yeah, I have re-recorded a few things, usually live, but sometimes studio versions of the Genesis things.
In fact, just recently, I guess worth breaking up, you re-recorded your big hit from GTR, When the Heart Rules the Mind, right?
That's right, yeah. I don't know if anyone's publicly heard that yet, but I have redone that, yeah. I'll be playing it live on the forthcoming concerts, so there'll be solo stuff, there'll be a tiny bit of GTR, and then there'll be the Genesis stuff. But, yeah, I re-recorded that. I always liked the song, and I always wanted to do my own version, and Steve Rothery joined me on it. That's some additional guitar. Steve Rothery of Marillion. He and I have been doing one or two things together recently, showing up on each other's things, and we may well do a project together. So, yeah, Return to GTR. That's something that many people have asked if I was ever going to either play that stuff or reform the band. And, you know, one tries at these reformations, but they're not always that easy. Meanwhile, I always think the reason for doing any of those things is to celebrate the music that people once liked, and they might like the new versions.
That'd be cool if that makes it out at any certain point. Be interested to hear that. I know a lot of people would be.
Yeah, I think it will. I think they're going to release it as a single, I believe. And if for some reason that gets overlooked, I'll stick it on an album at some point, probably later in the year.
Well, I know it's always sort of a tightrope walk when you're revisiting a lot of this stuff and, you know, celebrating an album like Wind and Wuthering. You know, it's a classic record and adding what do you try to get out of that? Do you try to add a new stamp to it, or are you just serving sort of the memory of it for the fans?
Well, I think I think it was the last album I did with the band. I haven't re-recorded it as a studio album. I'm just celebrating the fact that it was its 40th birthday. You know, every now and again, there'll be someone in the Genesis office who'll say, oh, you realize next year will be the 50th anniversary of anything that Genesis ever did. That she said, but I don't think there'll be a reformation, do you? And I said, well, you know, I'm always open to that. But meanwhile, you know, I like to honor and celebrate things for various reasons. I spend a long time, decades, doing solo stuff, and rather shorter time doing or celebrating the Genesis stuff. And I just tell people that in 1973, when we were unable to get a gig practically anywhere in the States, John Lennon gave an interview and said, and that was the time we were doing Selling England by the Pound, he said that Genesis was one of the bands he was listening to. So would that we could have capitalized on it at the time with Twitter and all the rest. But, you know, that sort of stuff wasn't around. So decades later, it comes to light that we were one of the bands that had John Lennon's ear for even for 5 seconds. I was pleased with that at the time, as the other Genesis guys were. It did something for us, but, you know, it was only the ripple effect. I like to honor the stuff, the early stuff, that often I find, you know, bandmates can often be quite dismissive of the early stuff, but I like to remind, and, you know, there was an audience for that. Those albums did sell very well, but it's not all about the numbers. It's about much more than that for me.
Now, you mentioned, of course, you know, when things start to happening like that, with 50th anniversaries happening every single year at this point, and the reformation come up.
There's often this, you know, missed opportunities, and I like to pull focus and say, no, it doesn't have to be a missed opportunity. But I'm not going to celebrate 50 years of Genesis, but, you know, there'll probably be, I think something's going to happen with Lamb Lies Down on Broadway, God knows what, a reissue, extra sleeve note. But, you know, this is something that people have had already, you know, so it's, you know, how much of a retread can there be? Meanwhile, I continue to record new stuff, and I'm halfway through a new album. The last album I did, last studio album, had 20 people on it from all around the world. We had Israeli working with Palestinian, Azerbaijan working with Iceland, working with Hungary, United Kingdom, United States, just to mention a few, 20 people from all around the world. So I celebrate that as well. I like to celebrate all of these eras, and I think it did very well.
Yeah, it being so multicultural, I mean, it's a really good time to be doing that, because it's...
Wouldn't it be ridiculous if you only worked with musicians from your own village? And, you know, I remember Mel Brooks doing, what was the sketch, The 2,000-Year-Old Man, or whatever it was called, and they asked him, what was the first national anthem? And he said, yeah, I think I can remember that, something like, God bless all those in Cave 13, and to hell with all the rest. That seems to be the way the politics is going again, so while politics goes Neanderthal, I want to go global, and I want to work with more and more people from around the world. I've been working with some Indian musicians recently. I'll be working with an orchestra with some British dates coming up soon, but with an American conductor, British orchestra, American conductor, you see. So we go Anglo-American. We do that. I think where politics fails us, music can do that. Music knows no borders, neither should it.
And then, so you have been taking that whole idea that you did in the studio with the Night Siren, and that is bleeding into these live shows as well.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. You know, I do a little bit of that. I don't do too much. I don't want to be too didactic about it. I don't want to pound the table about this, but I think that, you know, my own family were a refugee family coming out of Eastern Europe, coming out of Poland, surviving persecution, and they were allowed into the UK in the late 1800s. Not too much trouble, it seems, except at home. So I often say to people, otherwise I wouldn't be standing here, you know, for all those Brexiteers and those who are anti-foreigner and anti-refugee and all that. So, you don't have to look too far back. I don't think we should be building walls. We should be tearing them down. We managed to tear down the Berlin Wall, didn't we? I remember seeing Paul Butterfield talking of politics and music. I remember seeing him playing in 1966 to a very small audience doing a stunning show that featured Mike Bloomfield and Elvin Bishop. But he had Howlin' Wolf's rhythm section, I believe. I believe it was Sam Lay and Jerome Arnold at that time. And whilst there were race riots going on in Alabama, this was what was possible. You know, the most stunning blues show I'd ever seen. And I was listening to a lot of blues at that time.
With this live record, you know, as you're saying, you're kind of celebrating a classic album like Wind and Wuthering, as well as playing the Night Siren. Did you, when you construct, you know, a set list or anything, did you ever try to sort of blend the two concepts together? Or was it kind of an A and B side type of thing?
Yeah, I think, you know, I used to do that. And I would sometimes arrange something so that, you know, I might do just the guitar solo from first to fifth, which would, you know, draw a big response, and I was very grateful for that, and a nice piece of music and everything. But I think what changed my mind about it was I was in Sicily. I was doing an acoustic show with Julian Colbeck, and a guy showed up at the hotel, and he had just about every solo album I'd ever done, and I signed them all in the lobby for him. And then he sheepishly had this other pile, and he said, I don't know how you feel about signing these. And it was the Genesis album, as if it was contraband. And he thought I was going to hit the roof. But I thought, perhaps, having signed those, it was time to reclaim the heritage and celebrate it. And that's what gave me the idea of re-recording many of those tunes, albeit with an enlarged team and an orchestra, and guys who were from, like-minded bands of a similar era. So, you know, there were, over time, you know, I'd been working with guys from Yes, guys from King Crimson, guys from Jethro Tull. You know, there was all sorts of stuff that was going on, and latterly, you know, guys from the ELP and all the rest. And, you know, the surviving members of all those bands, you know, we all know each other. So I guess it's a time where, yes, I realize that to some degree, I think my job is, as Tony Banks said to me, he said, you know, you're preserving the heritage, aren't you? You know, I said, yes, I feel I'm doing that. I mean, I know that, you know, when they reformed as a three-piece some years ago, I guess, you know, they were preserving their idea of the heritage, but I think it was 20 years since Genesis last recorded anything in the studio together. But I can't answer for everyone else, so it's important to me to say, you know, it was important then and it's important now. I fought hard for those songs then. I fight hard for them now, and I do enlargements of them. I, you know, often do this, or I intend to often do it with orchestra. Mm-hmm. I will be doing 6 dates in the UK with orchestra. So I'm kind of putting my money where my mouth is, saying I think this is important.
It is worth asking. I mean, Tony and Mike have both said that they don't rule it out, that, you know, they could do it. And obviously Phil is back out there now. Do you see the benefit of and would have an interest in going out with them another time, either touring
or
just recording?
You know, I think, you know, that it's obvious to them that as I'm celebrating Genesis material, and I've said publicly I'm up for that, you know, whether it's a reformation to do something like Lambeth down on Broadway, which they initially approached me about, I said, yes, of course, yeah, if you call me if you need me. But I think it's possible, and of course, you know, the company line is always, I wouldn't rule it out, but I think it's highly improbable, so I wouldn't rule it in either. I'm open to it, but I think I wouldn't rule it out line is getting a little bit, you know, perhaps the timeline on that one has run out.
Well, I mean, that's I was speaking to Tony recently, and he did allude to time may be running out if you were to give it a go for another round.
Yeah, time may indeed be running out. But then I had an uncle who lived until he was 108. So I have no intention of retiring. I seem to be getting busier. I'm doing more and more projects with, you know, I've shown up on tons and tons of albums of other people. Usually that's rock, but sometimes it's some version of jazz or it's classical. I try and embrace all the genres. I've got this pan-genre affectation, if you like. Call it what you will. Call it collision, call it fusion, call it prog. Call it anything you like. But I adore music in all its forms. And I intend to do that until I drop. And I'm very happy to do that. You know, I think music is the nearest thing to the fountain of youth. Keeps me going, keeps me focused, keeps me happy. And my wife loves to travel. She's a fine historian. She can write books on subjects where she needs no source material. She's always completing my education by taking me off to India, where I've been working with some musicians from there, and looking at temples and discovering the history and many things. She loves to travel, so in that sense, it's perfect for the two of us. Anywhere we visit, she might well say to me in England, a little village, she might say, oh, you do realize this was a Roman stronghold, and they had, you know, a garrison 2,000 strong here, and she'll start reeling off the figures. This place called Brampton was once called Brantuna. So, yeah, it's an education.
Yeah,
I'm trying to convince her to do a book about Greek mythology, because she doesn't need any source material for that. She lives it, absolutely lives it. I've been to Greece a few times with her, and I know we'll go again. I think that's her true passion.
One of those, there's a very famous line, I think, that, well, at least I've read about, I'm assuming it's true, that when you were looking for a band in the early 70s, you put out the ad that said, looking for someone who's determined to strive beyond existing stagnant musical forms. And if that's true, it sounds like that's still the mantra. That's still the mantra.
I think so, yeah, that's it, yeah. If music can retain its element of surprise, whether it's a short song or if it's, you know, Wagner's Ring cycle or the progressive equivalent, I don't mind. I don't mind if it's supper's ready. See, it's ironic that with Genesis in 1972, I wrote something that was the preamble to Supper's Ready. So the shortest song that Genesis ever did, which was 90 seconds long, I wrote. And then there's Supper's Ready, the longest thing that we ever did, you know, ironically, side by side. And as I say, you know, it's not the form, it's not the length of the play, it's the quality of the acting, it's the quality of the playing, it's the quality of the writing, I think. I don't really mind how long it is or how short it is.
I'll apply that to your career, and I hope it's so much, much more longer, because I'm enjoying everything that you're doing out there.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm really having a great time out there right now. It's been really good. We're working with a new bass player, another Swedish guy called Jonas Reingold, and he's an absolute virtuoso. I've heard him playing Bach on the bass, and then playing jazz, and then doing, you know, this Rickenbacker type stuff, you think, wow, you know, this guy. He learned one of the most difficult tunes I've ever been involved with in 2 days flat. We just said, you know, we might throw this one in the set as you've got all the rest together. And he did. He absolutely nailed it, which is amazing. I wish I had a photographic memory like that. Flying fingers, photographic memory. That's it. That's the best way.
Well, again, Wuthering Heights is made for a really great listen. It's a really fun live album. And congrats on getting the number one slot on Amazon.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, I'm really so proud of that. So thank you. Lovely talking to you.
You too.
And hope we get to talk again.
Yeah, all right. Take care, Steve.
All the best.
All right, you too. Bye.
Thank you. Ciao.
A 2018 interview with Steve Hackett talking about the live album Wuthering Heights live in Birmingham. And again, the brand new record is called At the Edge of Light. And hey, if you haven't already, please do hit that subscribe button wherever you're listening from right now, whether that's YouTube, Spotify, iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Acast, Podchaser, really wherever you're getting this from. Hit that subscribe button and then head over to WFPK.org. That's where I do a show every Monday through Thursday from noon to 3 Eastern, where you can also find some bonus episodes of this series. ConsequenceOfSound.net, they've got all your music and film news needs. You can find me at Twitter at Kyle Meredith, Facebook.com/Kyle Meredith. That does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.